Alhamdulillah. And it is this very powerful, filled with emotion and knowledge and a sense of feeling. And this is the tongue of the heart. When the heart begins to feel and speak on its own these different adhkar, or for example, the salat, the five daily prayers. At one point, we can just merely recite the five daily prayers with our tongue. But there's another time when we recite these prayers and we really feel like we are reciting this prayer. We can feel within our heart as if these waves of spirituality are emanating from our heart, and they're just, you know, pushing outwards like these kind of waves in an ocean. And you're saying, Alhamdulillah, Subhanallah. And so this is the tongue of the heart. Now what happens is that that the information that we receive and the knowledge that we gain over a period of time, the tongue is constantly saying these things, but we educate and we teach our heart so that the tongue of the heart begins to open, and it is the tongue of the heart that begins to speak and is the one that is truly doing the different dhikr, the different remembrances and supplications and prayers and du'as, etc. Of course, at the beginning, the heart is merely a learner and the tongue is a teacher, because the tongue is constantly repeating these things to the heart. And then the heart begins to repeat and the heart begins to understand. But eventually, we see that whenever the tongue speaks, the heart will also speak. And so the heart at this point is the follower of the tongue. The rest to be continued in the next segment. جل جلال الله جل جلال الله
IRIB English Radio. Our website www.parstoday.com.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
وَذُرْوَةُ سَلَامِهِ الْجِهَادِ. That really the acme of this is this struggle. And jihad means defending the lands of the Muslims. It means all of the other things. There's jihad al-asghar wal-akbar. And that division is absolutely sound division, recognized by all of the ulama. This idea, because the hadith is weak, رَجَعْنَا مِنَ الْجِهَادِ الْأَصْغَرِ إِلَى الْجِهَادِ الْأَكْبَرِ, that hadith, the meaning is sound. And the ulama have always accepted that. That the greater jihad is the jihad of the self, or the soul, and the lesser jihad is the jihad of the enemy. So the inward enemies, the four inward, inshallah we'll get to that, the four inward enemies. And if you conquer those inward enemies, the outward enemies are nothing. They're nothing. But the inward enemies are the real enemies of the human being. And then he says, ثُمَّ قَالَ أَلَا أُخْبِرُكَ بِمِلَاكِ ذَلِكَ كُلِّهِ. Can I tell you how to get all of this? Do you want to know how you can get all of this? I mean, this is an amazing statement. Do you want to know how you can obtain all of that? And then he says, فَأَخَذَ بِلِسَانِهِ, that blessed tongue that had all those meanings that flowed from it and all that wisdom. He took his tongue. He took hold of his tongue. And he said to him, كُفَّ عَلَيْكَ هَذَا. Just control this. Just control your tongue. That's the milak. That's how تَمْلِكُهُ. You'll be able to possess all of those other things if you do this jihad. And then, Qudsu, Ya Nabi Allah, he's amazed. Right? Mu'adh, Ya Nabi Allah, Wa inna la mu'akhaduna bima natakallamu bihi? Are we going to be taken to account for what we're talking? Because the Arabs, to them, speech was not action. Their understanding was a man could have words, but he had to be a man of deeds. And the Ayyam al-Arab are all about deeds. The words glorified the deeds. Right? Their poetry was glorification of deeds. And so he's saying, are we going to be taken to account for what we say? And then he says, فَقَادَ ثَكِرَتْكَ أُمُّكَ. Right? And this is an Arab idiom that, even though it literally means like your mother is weeping over you as if you've died, you know, but it's a hyperbole to say, you're really missing the point here, you know. And he said, ثَكِرَتْكَ أُمُّكَ وَهَلْ يَكُبَّ النَّاسَ فِي النَّارِ عَلَى وُجُوهِهِمْ أَوْ قَالَ عَلَى مَنَاخِرِهِمْ إِلَّا حَصَائِدُ أَلْسِنَتِهِمْ. Will people be dragged in the hell on their faces, or he said on their noses, by other than the harvest of their tongues? The harvest of their tongues. So this is, I mean, that hadith should be enough to tell you the importance of the tongue.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were talking about, which was this idea that, first of all, we wanted to answer what is the tongue of the heart, and the second thing that we wanted to answer was how do we make it speak, and finally, how this is related to our ubudiyya. So in the first segment, we kind of talked about this idea that the tongue of the heart is similar to the tongue of the actual tongue, except that the tongue of the actual tongue is just this mere recitation or saying of, you know, a certain phrase or a statement or a prayer or a dua or a supplication. But the tongue of the heart is a very deep, profound, filled with emotion, filled with belief, and it really emanates from within the heart. It is a much more profound and powerful type of recitation of that same dua or supplication or salat, namaz, etc. So now we know what the tongue of the heart is. Now, we also started to speak about how we can get it to speak. And of course, the way to get it to speak is to continuously be teaching the heart the meanings of these different recitations and incantations, for lack of a better word. We teach it to the heart so that the heart slowly starts to speak. And we have to kind of focus and concentrate and pay attention that when we are saying these things with our tongue, that our heart is also connected. So it takes a little bit of paying attention and focus and trying to really feel what it is that we are saying and to really believe in what we are saying. Now, before we talk about how it's related to our ubudiyya, we continue our journey. So we had left off in the last segment that what happens is that whenever the tongue speaks or says a certain recitation, the heart at the same time also says the recitation. But after the heart's tongue begins to speak, we will find that the contrary happens. The heart becomes the invoker and the tongue begins to follow it in its invocations and recitations. Up to a point where, in fact, sometimes even when a person is sleeping, their tongue starts speaking in pursuit of their heart's invocation and recitation, as the heart's recitation is not confined to a state of wakefulness. And when the heart remembers, the tongue follows along.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah,
ya Allah, ya Mannan, haqqa.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
And so this is the ultimate phase or the ultimate stage, and that is where even though the tongue might not be speaking, but the heart is speaking, and the heart and the tongue of the heart is constantly in this state of belief and is constantly in this state of recitation and the remembrance and the dhikr of the Almighty Allah, to a point where it is constantly reciting, even if an individual's physical tongue is not reciting. And so here at the end, what is the connection with ubudiyya? Well, this is one of the aspects or one of the angles of the overall ubudiyya that we talk about, this servitude and obedience and worship to Allah. And you might ask how? Well, of course, first and foremost, ubudiyya in general is a spiritual wayfaring. It's a journey. Whether it happens quickly or slowly over a long period of time or a short period of time, that is up to debate, and it depends on various variables. But what is the common denominator is that it is a journey. It has stages. It has phases in different aspects. And one of the aspects is this speaking of the tongue and the speaking of the heart. Now, the first stages in this ubudiyya, this obedience and servitude and worship to Allah, of course, is the tongue speaking. And then it is teaching the heart. And then finally, it is the heart speaking. In the first stage, the heart follows the tongue. In the final stages, the tongue follows the heart. And it could well be said that towards the later stages, the tongue might even become silent while the heart continues to remember and be in the presence constantly of the Almighty Allah. And so teach your tongue, and then teach your heart, and then your heart will teach you the roads and the paths and the journey of ubudiyya, the servitude, the worship, and the obedience to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S. brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Nakura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Nakara is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Nakura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in his statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Nakura, South Lebanon.
Many millions of people living across the 27-nation EU are struggling to survive. Brussels resident Jefferson Araujo has endured two rent increases since March. His landlord says her mortgage is going up, and so a further rent hike is needed.
You go to the market, you cannot buy anything anymore because the price is too high. And I'm thinking maybe to leave Brussels because I'm working in a hotel 10 hours a day. Like sometimes I have just one day off a week.
In an attempt to bring down soaring inflation, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro, has announced interest rates are going up by a further 75 basis points. That represents a huge increase for people repaying home loans. The economic outlook could get even worse, the ECB warns.
Confidence could deteriorate further, and supply-side constraints could worsen again. Energy and food costs could also remain persistently higher than expected.
Some EU leaders have warned the ECB that increasing interest rates so aggressively could push the eurozone into a deep recession. Higher rates impede business expansion and employment. Charities fighting social injustice often point out all of those taking the decisions that lead to higher inflation and interest rates are insulated from the impact simply because they are the richest individuals in society. Critics say the EU's move to cut out Russia's cheap gas over the war in Ukraine is backfiring. Despite this, a ninth round of sanctions against Moscow is being prepared.
The Commission and the EES are obviously constantly working in the context of the sanctions on making sure that we are ready should there be a need for further sanctions.
Peace seems to be a dirty word in Western capitals. This as the US weapons and energy sectors make enormous profits, while ordinary EU citizens pay a very high price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranians have held nationwide rallies to condemn the Wednesday terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz. The protesters took to the streets in different cities following Friday prayers. They chanted slogans and held banners, calling for the perpetrators and their backers to be brought to justice.
Today, we're here to show the world that we are all together. We are a powerful country. We're going to fight against terrorism. We're going to fight against violence. You want us to be separated. You want us to fight against each other, but we are the one. We are powerful.
At least 13 people, including two children, were killed after gunmen opened fire on pilgrims at the Shah Charagh Holy Shrine in Shiraz. 26 others were wounded. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility shortly after the attack.
We strongly condemn any acts of terrorism and desecration of Muslim sanctities. We want to say that we hate London-based news channels like Iran International, Manoto and BBC because they are instigating violence and unrest in Iran.
We are here to send this message to Israel, the U.S. and their allies that through creating riots and unrest in the country, they cannot achieve their sinister goal of disintegration of Iran. We are united.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called on security agencies, the judiciary, intellectuals, activists, and the entire nation to act in unison to confront the current which is disregarding and disrespecting people's lives, security, and sanctities. Meanwhile, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has also vowed that the Islamic Republic would deliver a crushing response to those who were behind the bloodshed.
The ralliers have called on Iranian authorities to prosecute the main perpetrators of the heinous crime of terrorist attack in Shiraz and take all necessary measures to maintain security in the country as soon as possible. Saman Kujurib, Tehran.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favor, 79 against, and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election.
Among the many weights I have on my shoulders today is the fact that I am the first woman ever to lead this nation as Prime Minister.
During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds.
Ma la nostra priorità.
Our priority today must be to curb high energy prices and accelerate in every way the diversification of supply sources and domestic production. The context in which the government will have to act is very complicated, perhaps the most difficult since the World War II.
Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia after its annexation of Crimea.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement is doubling down on its threats to target foreign cargo ships attempting to enter Yemeni waters illegally to steal oil and other natural resources. This after the government recently fired warning shots toward a Greek oil ship attempting to illegally load an estimated 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil from a port terminal in the province of Hadramaut. The warning shots forced the Greek cargo ship to abandon its mission and use its own fuel to head back home empty-handed.
This fuel ship was attempting to steal 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil worth millions of dollars. This money is supposed to be allocated to the Central Bank of Yemen, which would then be distributed to pay labor salaries across the country. Unfortunately, this money was transferred to a bank belonging to the Saudi royal family and was used to fund the American-Saudi aggression on Yemen.
According to the government in Sana'a, ending years of plundering and looting of the Yemeni natural wealth is essential to stimulate the Yemeni economy. It also pulls Yemen out of the decades of poverty and economic instability, which has already left millions of Yemenis in poverty. An initiative, the Sana'a government says, is promising to make it a reality. Observers believe that the world now needs to recognize that it is dealing with a new Yemeni nation, one that will never compromise its dignity and sovereignty.
The new identity of Yemen is because people's demands are now being met, whereby the Yemeni people are finally getting what they deserve as they reap the benefit of their natural resources, which used to be exploited and plundered. The latest warning shots we sent are an example of the military and political leadership's strengths, pose, and determination to protect the people of Yemen.
Yemen has for decades been described as the poorest country in the Middle East. However, the underlying reasons why that is the case are hardly ever discussed. According to experts we spoke with, one of the main reasons is the systematic exploitation of Yemen's natural wealth by the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
With the latest developments, foreign countries and companies who have a history in plundering Yemen's natural resources will have to think twice about entering the country's waters illegally, as the Ansar Allah movement has made it very clear it will not hesitate to use decisive military force to protect what it calls the Yemeni people's wealth. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials, he definitely has the experience, been there in the as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC 23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth. What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light-years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us. And we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution, and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. In the U.S., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul Pelosi, has been attacked at their California home with a hammer. The attacker has been identified as 42-year-old David DePape. DePape will be charged with attempted homicide, among other charges, according to San Francisco police. A motive for the attack is still unknown. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Guardian has more on this story. Paul Pelosi, husband of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, was hospitalized with a skull fracture on Friday, 28th of October, after he was attacked at the couple's home in California with a hammer by an assailant who was reported to have shouted, "Where is Nancy? Where is Nancy?" Paul Pelosi, an 82-year-old, underwent successful surgery to repair a skull fracture and other serious injuries sustained during the assault, and is expected to make a full recovery, according to Nancy Pelosi's spokesperson, Drew Hamill. Earlier, on Friday morning, Paul Pelosi was attacked at home by an assailant who acted with force and threatened his life while demanding to see the Speaker of the House. Drew Hamill said in a statement on Friday afternoon, 28th of October, San Francisco police said that Paul Pelosi managed to call 911 but didn't directly report what was happening, but that a dispatcher sent police officers to follow up with a well-being check at about 2:27 a.m. local time in the early hours of Friday morning. They found an adult male confronting Paul Pelosi, and a hammer was being grasped by both men. The suspect pulled the hammer away from Pelosi and violently assaulted him with it. Our officers immediately tackled the suspect, disarmed him, took him into custody, said Bill Scott, the chief of the San Francisco Police Department. Bill Scott named the suspect as David DePape, a 42-year-old, and said he broke in through a back door. Charges are to be brought at the San Francisco County Jail, including attempted homicide, assault with a deadly weapon, abuse of an elderly person, burglary, and other felonies. David DePape remained in the hospital on Friday evening, but the San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott did not disclose his condition. Scott said police were still investigating the motive for the attack, but said this was not a random act, this was intentional. It was reported by CNN that the suspect intended to tie the victim up until Nancy Pelosi got home, and that he had posted right-wing and conspiracy theories online, including content promoting the lie that former President Donald Trump was deprived of victory in the 2020 presidential election because of voter fraud. In a statement to CNN, an acquaintance of David DePape said he appeared to be out of touch with reality. Two of the suspect's relatives also told the network that DePape, who grew up in British Columbia, Canada, was estranged from his family. In addition to multiple conspiracy posts on his Facebook account, which was reviewed by CNN and later taken down by Meta on Friday. David DePape is also believed to have managed a blog to which he regularly posted screeds concerning the ruling class. The blog, which the San Francisco Chronicle reviewed and was later taken down, had a banner that said, "Welcome to Big Brother's censorship hell," along with numerous conspiracy posts about the US government, media outlets, and technology companies. President Joe Biden called the attack on Paul Pelosi despicable and denounced people who spread lies about stolen elections for corroding the political climate in America and contributing to politically motivated violence. "Enough is enough," Joe Biden told supporters at a Democratic Party fundraiser in Philadelphia on Friday, 28th of October. "Every person of good conscience needs to clearly and unambiguously stand up against the violence in our politics, regardless of what your politics are. Democracy is literally, not figuratively, on the ballot this year," said Joe Biden, who warned about the dangers of extremism in an impassioned speech in Philadelphia last month. The president said reports indicated the attack on Paul Pelosi was aimed at Nancy Pelosi and noted that the suspected assailant used the same chant, "Where is Nancy?" heard from supporters of former President Donald Trump when they stormed the U.S. Capitol building on 6th of January 2021. Joe Biden said it was not surprising that one party's repeated lies about stolen elections could affect people who may not be so well-balanced. According to the Associated Press, the attacker had specifically targeted the Pelosi family home. Video footage of the house showed glass shattered in a side entrance, indicating where the break-in may have occurred. A person briefed on the situation told the Associated Press that the intruder had confronted Paul Pelosi while demanding to know where his wife was. The speaker, who is second in line to succeed the president, was not at home at the time of the attack, but was in Washington, D.C. with security protection that accompanies her at all times. The website of NBC News has more details for us. San Francisco's district attorney said they expect to file attempted murder and other charges against the man accused of attacking Paul Pelosi with a hammer at his home on Friday, 28th of October. "Anytime you strike someone in the head in the fashion that Mr. Pelosi was hit, it is clear to us that he was attempting to kill him," District Attorney Brooke Jenkins told NBC Bay Area on Friday evening. She told the station her office expects to file charges of attempted murder, residential burglary, abuse of an elderly person, and assault with a deadly weapon. The suspect, David DePape, is accused of breaking into the Pelosi home and striking Paul Pelosi, the husband of Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, at least once with a hammer. Paul Pelosi, an 82-year-old, underwent surgery for a skull fracture and is now recovering, a spokesman for Nancy Pelosi has confirmed. San Francisco Police Chief Bill Scott said the attack was intentional and not a random act. A motive in the assault has not been released. David DePape was in hospital on Friday, 28th of October, but will be booked one way or the other, either in person or in absentia, Bill Scott said. Meanwhile, Representative Benny Thompson, the chairman of the House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol riot, called the attack on Paul Pelosi abhorrent and urged his congressional colleagues to reject divisive conspiracy theories that he said have fueled violence. Unfortunately, the attack against Paul Pelosi appears to be a symptom of a much larger problem within our democracy, said Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi. He added, "In recent years, we have seen a rise in domestic terrorism fueled in part by violent, racist, anti-Semitic and anti-democratic rhetoric." Vinnie Thompson cited the deadly 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the Capitol riot of 6th of January 2021 as examples of how armed attackers have used violence to impose their views. So-called vigilantes have been intimidating voters at ballot drop boxes and harassing local election officials. America is better than this, Vinnie Thompson added. I call on my colleagues in Congress and elected officials across the nation to put country over party and reject the conspiracy theories that are proving so divisive, despite any perceived political advantage, Vinnie Thompson said. Thompson, who also chairs the House Committee on Homeland Security, called on federal agencies and law enforcement to reinforce efforts to protect officials and elections as the midterm elections approach.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers, dear sisters, salamun alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have an interesting story, and I invite you to listen to it. The title of today's story is Dr. Goldsmith. There was once a king, a kind man whose name was Oliver Goldsmith. He wrote many delightful books, some of which you will read when you are older. He had a gentle heart. He was always ready to help others and to share with them anything that he had. He gave away so much to the poor that he was always poor himself. He was sometimes called Dr. Goldsmith, for he had studied to be a physician. One day, a poor woman asked Dr. Goldsmith to go and see her husband, who was sick and could not eat. Goldsmith did so. He found that the family was in great need. The man had not had work for a long time. He was not sick, but in distress. And as for eating, there was no food in the house. "Call at my room this evening," said Goldsmith to the woman, "and I will give you some medicine for your husband." In the evening, the woman called. Goldsmith gave her a little paper box that was very heavy. "Here is the medicine," he said. "Use it faithfully, and I think it will do your husband a great deal of good. But don't open the box until you reach home." What are the directions for taking it?" asked the woman. "You will find them inside of the box," he answered. When the woman reached her home, she sat down by her husband's side and they opened the box. What do you think they found in it? It was full of pieces of money, and on the top were the directions: "To be taken as often as necessity requires." Goldsmith had given them all the ready money that he had. Thank you very much. Really, that was a very interesting story. And we'll listen to the points of this story and the continuation of Lantern. Be with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Lantern, our topic of discussion that is sadaqah or alms, what is known generally as alms. Sadaqah or alms refer to the money or property donated to poor people for the sake of God. According to Islamic doctrines, it is not permissible to acquire money or property by every means, as it is not permissible to spend money in every way. One of the most recommended ways to spend one's money is to give it as alms or sadaqah. According to verses of the Holy Quran, there are two sorts of alms, obligatory and recommended. So we have definitely two types of alms or sadaqah. One is obligatory and the other one is recommended. Quranic verses have also specified ways in which alms should be spent. According to hadith and narrations, giving one's money as alms doesn't lead to decrease in one's possessions. Rather, it leads to its increase. So this is what has been said even by one of the infallibles that said that I guarantee that one's possessions and property will get will find a high increase in case they pay their alms. So let's again talk about the concept itself. Alms is the money spent for the sake of God, as I said, such as zakat. However, the term sadaqah is used for the money spent as a recommended action, whereas zakat is used for the money given as an obligatory duty. Giving one's money for the sake of God is called tasadduq, that is sadaqah or alms, and the money spent in this way is called sadaqah. About the importance of this concept, or let's say the concept of sadaqah or alms, or alms giving, according to the Quranic verse in chapter 9, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Allah himself receives the alms. أَلَمْ يَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهُ يَقْبَلُ التَّوْبَةَ عَنْ عِبَادِهِ وَيَأْخُذُ الصَّدَقَاتِ وَأَنَّ اللَّهُ وَالتَّوَّابُ الرَّحِيمُ. Do they not know that it is Allah who accepts the repentance and his servants and receives the charities, and that is Allah who is the all-clement, all-merciful? According to tafsir Namuna of Ayatollah Makarem Shirazi, this verse shows the significance of alms. It encourages Muslims to give alms and tells them to respect people to whom they give their alms and zakat, since they are received by God. According to a hadith from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, alms goes to the hand of the person in need only after it goes to the hand of God. That is, first it goes to the hand of God, and after that it goes to the hand of the needy or the poor. The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So there are some types of alms or sadaqah that we want to talk about. That we mentioned actually the two types, but we need to talk about them in details. One is obligatory. What do we mean by obligatory alms or sadaqah? In this type of alms, the person has the religious obligation to give a specific portion of his or her possessions to a specific people under certain conditions. Something like zakat, khums, and fitriya are instances of such alms. Now, let's talk about the recommended ones. What are the recommended alms or sadaqah? This sort of alms has no specific amount. It is recommended to give any amount of one's money to any person in need for the sake of God. So, is there any features or conditions, or are there any features or conditions for that? Definitely, yes. As we mentioned in some of the hadith, or let's say as based on our understanding of the narrations, hadith and the Holy Quran, certain conditions need to be met in order to for the alms to be valid. It should be from one's legitimate possessions and property. Then it's better to be given in secret. It should not be accompanied by reproaching the person who is given the alms. So we have to be careful not to reproach and belittle the person or underestimate the person. The alms that we are going to give should be out of pure intention for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Pure intention. And the next point is that it has to be from the possessions that one likes rather than the ones that one wants to get rid of. Sometimes I have, let's say, a cloth, let's say a shirt, or I don't know, trousers that I want to get rid of. I give it as alms. No, it's not. So it should not be like that. The person who gives alms should never take himself or herself to be a real owner. Rather, they should take themselves to be intermediaries between God and his people. That is, I'm not giving something from my own real possessions. Whatever is at my hand, it belongs to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, who are eligible people for alms? Who are the ones who are eligible for the alms? I want to share some points about the eligible, let's say, community or addressees of the alms. According to Al-Quran, there are eight classes of people who are eligible for alms. The poor people, that is, fuqara, the needy one, that is, masakin, those who are employed to collect zakat, those whose hearts have been recently reconciled to Islam, al-mu'allafatu qulubuhum, that is, for the ta'lif of qulub, for the closeness of the hearts, the emancipation of slaves, those in debt if they have not committed any crimes. So I hope that you find this show beneficial, and I'd like to invite you to listen to us in our upcoming sessions where we shall talk about some other issues. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.